set out now in a box upon the sea.
Boston, of course, was the cultural center around Harvard, particularly of the early New England, before before the United States of America, even, and very much the place where the arts and poetry and the rest were happening. And the young Unitarian second generation, Emerson and Thoreau, went to Harvard and became young ministers, you know, in the area. They started rebelling against the more conservative older generation, and their more dogmatic Christianity, you might say. Although William Ellery Channing, who was one of the founders of Unitarianism, was far from conservative. He was evolving in a very progressive way and was very influential on this young generation who went and listened to him in the pulpit in Boston. Federal Street Church was called at that time. And now it's the Arlington Street Church in Boston. And Channing was a brilliant, very brilliant, and very far-reaching in his theology, developing almost a humanistic Christianity, humanistic liberal Christianity, you'd say, and powerfully influential. And he paid attention to the young guard when the older people of his generation were not. He was much more open to progressive thought and the rest. And they venerated him, and he gave them recognition. Thought they really had a great contribution there, man, which was so. This last Sunday was Margaret Fuller's 200th birthday. And we're doing her bicentennial. Like, that's why I came out to Manhattan, up this way. I was going to be at this Universalist thing, but I had the date. I thought it was a Saturday, and it was a Sunday. Susan got to get back. And they heard me anyway last year. I talked about it. And as a woman, she couldn't go to Harvard. And her father was her tutor. He was a congressman out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, born there. And she was brilliant and way ahead of the guys who were going there to Harvard. Theodore Parker and James Freeman Clark and others who became part of this transcendentalist movement. And so she palled around with them.
Kerouac's buried in Parker's Cemetery in Lowell.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And in Lowell, Massachusetts. In any case, they were the culture of the day. And, I grew up, they were somewhat in the they were recessive, you might say, in the sense that their mysticism and their intuitionist philosophy and had become a little passé. Emerson had become a little passé, you know. He very widely read in his day and had an impact on Europe even. Very, you know, the first American philosopher really to be taken seriously in Europe. And but by the time it played itself out, it had affected the whole of Unitarian Universalism and other religions as well. It was the liberal religion for the day, and it had tremendous impact, although people at first put it down and it was unorthodox and heresy and all that. By the time it had been around a while, it sunk in. But by the time I went to college, there was a little revival at Harvard in some of the American studies that Olson studied at, of American Transcendentalists by this guy Perry Miller, who was quite an astute scholar, came out with a book on American Transcendentalism. So it was just becoming back part of the thing to look at. And of course it had a lot to do with the revolution of the 60s and 70s, where again people and youngsters even keyed in on the writings like Walden and Thoreau and Emerson's writings to some extent, but largely Thoreau and some of the women writers. Margaret Fuller had tremendous influence in the 20s and 30s when there was a revival of feminism, because she wrote the classic work called Women in the 19th Century, which was a bestseller. She outsold and was outread Emerson. Emerson barely sold compared to Margaret Fuller. She ended up going down to New York and being a first woman journalist for the New York Tribune. And she'd write these tremendously long pieces nowadays, you think of them, for the paper. And she was the top literary art critic in the country. Travel, all that kind of stuff. And so she was very famous, very widely read, and her books were bestsellers. A scandal. People were shocked by her Women in the 19th Century, which was a first real treatise in America, in the United States, on women and their rights, although Judith Murray here in Gloucester was a predecessor writing on women's rights, but not a whole book or like Fuller had done. And was a playwright and a poet.
Victor Carpenter.
Victor Carpenter, come on down.
Hi, Victor.
It's Victor Carpenter.
Mr. Old Friend.
We're doing a little interview. Hey. Good to see you. You know this gal.
Indeed I do.
Hi.
Indeed I do. Indeed
what a treat.
Well, she was somewhat scandalous because she was very revolutionary in her thought. Want to keep? But became even more scandalous at the end of her life. She only lived to be 40. She and her husband and a baby died off the coast of New York in a boat crash coming back here to the States from Italy. And Boston was scandalous to the fact that she'd had a child at her age and that she was supposedly married, but they weren't so sure. She had the child out of wedlock and all that. But even more scandalous, she'd become a revolutionary in the usual understanding of the word in Rome, when the whole revolution was sweeping Europe in 1846 to 1850. And all the countries were having a class revolution where the masses of people were inspired by nationalism and by class uprising to form republics and get rid of the aristocracy and the church and everything else. Well, this was scandalous that she had this husband who was part of fighting in the revolution. She was first-hand friends with the leaders of the Italian Revolution, sending back dispatches to the New York Tribune about the ongoingness of the revolution. Well, they were published, but they were the only really truthful accounts of what was going on in Italy in particular. But she had spent time in Paris and London and on the way down to Italy. But Italy is where she took root and really loved to be, in Rome in particular.
So there's a lot of, between this political ground was really also Vincent, and I mean, that's one reason I think that there's another connection between Vince and Olson, even though Olson wasn't radical politically like Vincent was. There still was this, blue collar connection.
Very much.
Two of them.
Very much, and you know, Charles was out on the boats, and he was a postman, and he's a working man, and had to earn his living and best they could. And I would say, of course, Olson was anti-communist, and Vincent, I don't think ever became anti-communist, but he certainly felt betrayed by the party and all that, like many did who were part of the party in the early days. But he wasn't as deep into the real revolutionary perspective as Vincent was. But his thinking was quite radical, populist, I'd say more in tone, and rooted in the American Revolution and the spirit of the revolutionary movement of the Transcendentalists and the rest. The year Margaret ended up in Rome was the same year Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. And she was quite a class revolutionary, and and took up socialist and communist ideas, although it was more what you'd call a democratic socialist in their perspective. But kowtowed and mixed and was with the communists on the street, you know. But very much a part of it. She, during the uprising, when the Roman Republic was set up in January of 49, she was back in Rome and writing the dispatches, and was offered to be director of the hospital there in Rome for the wounded. And so she was the first Florence Nightingale. She was running a hospital for the wounded and the rest during this whole revolutionary period, while her husband was up on the guard, you know, guarding and protecting. Ultimately, it was the French who betrayed the revolution most, in that, of course, remember Beethoven felt very much betrayed by Napoleon after he'd written the Third Symphony for him, that he'd become a dictator. And the nephew of Napoleon, Bonaparte, took over France, and they sent an army down to Rome to liberate it, because the Roman Republic had been declared, and the Pope had fled in the night in his priest's outfit, and the people were jeering him.
I want to get back to this subject.
Back to Olson.
Why did you call me up the beginning of April and want to try to do this again?
I felt it was one of the drop stitches we had still, you know, that it was a very important project.
What was?
We were talking about here in Gloucester to get the place. That it was something we'd had in mind always, that Vincent's, he wanted it to be a poetry center. He wanted to bequeath it. But then again, his bills were so great, he couldn't bequeath it. So there it was sitting, as it sat, and the price seemed more affordable. It just seemed like, well, let's make a stab and try to do this before I go out here with my cancer. And I felt it was this town is very important to me, and its heritage, along with Berkeley and San Francisco and L.A., you know, that there's this close relationship between these areas that one wouldn't necessarily feel likely, but it comes out of the artistic tradition, particularly of San Francisco and L.A., which has a much stronger artistic tradition than people realize. And that's where, you know, I started my ministry there, and there was a tremendous movement of the arts there at that time in the 60s. So it was all of a piece, you might say. And I see it as part of the carrying on of the revolution. I think Margaret was correct. She later, let me read just one thing from her that she wrote in one of her last dispatches. She said, the next revolution here and elsewhere will be radical, she said. Not only Jerusalem must go, but the Roman Catholic religion must go. The Pope cannot remain even in his spiritual power. The influence of the clergy is too perverting, too foreign to every advancement in health. Not only the Austrian and every potentate of foreign blood must be deposed, but every man who assumes an arbitrary lordship over fellow man must be driven out. It will be an uncompromising revolution. England cannot reason nor ratify or criticize it. France cannot betray it. Germany cannot bungle it. Italy cannot bubble it away. Russia cannot stamp it down nor hide it in Siberia. The new era is no longer in embryo. It is born. It begins to walk. This very year sees its first giant steps and can no longer mistake its features. Men have long been talking of a transition state. It is over. The power of positive, determinate effort has begun. A faith is offered. Men are everywhere embracing it. The film is hourly falling from their eyes, and they see not only near but far, duties worthy to be done. God be praised, it was a dark period of the skeptical endeavor and work, only worthy as it's helping to educate the new generation. She's talking about the downfall of the Roman Republic that had been crushed. It was a dark period, but it was watered with much blood and tears. God be praised, that time has ended, and the noble band of teachers who have passed the past ordeal of the furnace and den of lions are ready now to enter for the elementary class. Well, the revolution has been continuous since that time, and we've seen upsurges and attempts to crush it. Obviously the 60s and 70s were a resurgence in this country. We thought the revolution was here. And they moved in with a malignant force, you know, to kill leadership and destroy it. But they couldn't destroy it. And we would have never had an Obama elected president without what people did in the 60s and 70s and back to transcendentalism. And to these original pioneer people who saw themselves outwardly as revolutionaries. Well, today in New England, they're a little scared of the word revolution. In the East, they're a little more scared of it than in the West. But they don't associate it with the nonviolent revolution, which is what's necessary and the only possible kind of revolution in our time. And we've had examples of it in our own time, giants who have been here with us, who showed the way, and it's still percolating. In fact, the moment now is open for it to be consummated. And my one regret is I think that the next 10 years we're going to see a consummation of some of these things. It will be outwardly recognized. People will not be scared of the word, and they'll be able to see that we've got to make great transformation in this country of the economic and social distribution of wealth and the ability to live in the world on a peaceful, harmonic basis of all cultures and people. And we're ready for it. And the masses of people are more ready for it than they were in the 60s and 70s. So, it's continuous. It's a permanent, ongoing effort that even, you know, Jefferson had said had to be watered with the blood of every generation. It always has to be reconstituted and reworked and regenerated.
you said in one of your emails, you quoted Olson, you said in one of his poems where he said, it's unfinished business.
Stretching out from our feet.
Stretching out from our feet.
Yeah. And it is. So he was a revolutionary. He was not a socialist. I think he had some socialist inklings, but he's democratic in his perspective. And he, even though he had a kind of an elite attitude about things, and he was, you know, way ahead, very visionary, but he was steeped in the tradition and culture and trying to keep it alive all the way back to the early Greeks, before Aristotle and Plato, back to Democritus and Heraclitus and the pre-Socratics. And it's a great heritage. And he enlivened it. He was educated in Cambridge, but he was not of it. You know, he was beyond the academy. And that's why, like Vincent, they were people who were very self-taught, as well as willing to dive into the academics, but not to be of it, and to be critical of it, and at the same time cultivate what was the wheat, you know, from the chaff. They were great figures, mm-hmm. And you know, we were lucky to be around them, and we got a great heritage to pass on, and. We're going to see a lot of, and especially our younger generation, are amazing in their capacities, and they're turning away from the moneyed game to the arts and culture, and to a good life, a quality of life and humaneness, you know, because the country's been on a dead trajectory. It's come to a dead end almost. I mean, Obama hasn't yet been able to bring the empire home, you know, but I think his intention is to have a world of peace, and he cares about people, and he's got you know, also class attitudes of the needs of the poorer people. Poorer working people.
Yeah.
But he needs to be supported as a person and criticized in his policies. There's a difference between the two. And we need to reach out to each other in what Baraka calls the United Front. That we can't discard anybody. Even the rich, you know, should not be discarded. They need to be taken from their great power and their dominance, but they need to be cultivated. There are many of our allies among the wealthy people. They know better. They know they're probably Rockefeller was more of a Marxist than anybody. You know, they knew about class power and class struggle, and you know, they certainly knew about class struggle.
tell me your vision for this house.
Well, my hope is it'll be one of many, but at least a outpost, you know, a project for the cultivation and making available what I was able to come in touch with in my life, what Vincent was able to come in touch with in his life, you know, and be a good little library of resources and a place where writers, because the writers are very important, the artists, this is a revolution of the arts. The arts are central to it. And the filmmaking now, you know, the most modern of all the arts. The power of our ability to educate and learn and cultivate our humanity together. And we do it together. These transcendentalists were a whole coterie of people who learned with each other. They weren't individualists, even though Emerson is held up as one of those great individualists, they did stress the uniqueness of human personality, but not as singular beings separated off from other people. It was all a communal effort, a community of learners together. And we all depend on each other. We need each other very badly. So that's part of the religious tradition that goes way back, as well as the up-to-date contemporary revival of a deeper insight.
I know you have to leave soon, so we'll wrap this up. But just give me your impressions of those early days, you know, walking over to, you know, going over to 126 East Main Street, knocking on Vincent's door, and
Well, it was a time of.
Actually, to preface that, mm-hmm. There was this quote that Annie was talking about of Peter Anastas, you know, what he said about going over to Vincent's. He'd go over there to talk about poetry, but he'd end up just talking about life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the we were riding a tremendous energy there in the late 50s when I went to Berkeley and the poetry renaissance there with Duncan and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg was out there, of course, and Kerouac and Snyder and all those people. So the tremendous energy in the cultural circles, you might say, just the learning and the sense of transformation that was possible. We felt the whole world was open to us, particularly the West Coast. You'd have that feeling because things weren't closed off as much, and there was a real revolutionary spirit. And then to come back, you know, out of that, you know, Cambridge was a little staid in its own way, but it too was a very exciting center for learning. And, you know, came up against all kinds of people from very cosmopolitan. And so to come back then and be able to connect with what was happening here, particularly with Olson and Creeley and Vincent and Gloucester, which was really alive and happening, was a very strong kind of bi-coastal warp and woof, you might say, and gave a very exciting context for what was going on. That spirit went on pretty well into the middle 70s, and then it got submerged somewhat by people turning back to get their lives together and live their lives and whatnot. We thought we had somewhat turned a corner away from the Johnson-Nixon war and all that.
I want to be more specific. Because my impressions of going into that, you know, Vincent didn't have a pot to piss in, so, you know, he was a monk.
Right.
And he lived in the 600 square foot space. But as soon as you walked into that space, there was like a vibe that got you, because it was like this little museum.
Yeah.
Right.
And here was this curator that would talk to you about, you know, whatever was on your mind.
Sure. But he always had an open door. And that was what was so nice about Vincent. You knew that no matter when, you know, it had to be daytime, not late at night or whatever, you knew that he had an open door and he was relational, and he was going to dig right in, pick up where you left off, you know. It could have been yesterday, 10 years ago, you know. And there he was. And a steady presence. His presence in Gloucester was of extraordinary moment. And he knew people, they knew him. And he was not only a character, but he had character. and not seeped in the literary stuff. It wasn't like going to visit a... Robert Duncan was totally different, you know. Again, a great raconteur and a great human being, but very literary, very oriented around literature and studies and all that, very deep into it.
You didn't necessarily have to have those reference points.
With Vincent, it was whoever you were, and you just relating. And he did a lot for a lot of people, I think. He had an open door, and they needed to talk, or he needed to talk, or whatever. And you always felt at home and connected, cross-continent. He was a very worldly guy for not leaving the town for a long time. And then he began to travel around, lived long enough to get out in the hustings. And but we had some wonderful times, him coming out to the West Coast. And he loved it too, coming out there. But it was life, like you say. It was not... the literature was just an offshoot. It was just, it was important, yeah. But not the center. The center were the human beings, right. And your relational qualities. Mm-hmm. And he kept your eye on that. He wouldn't let you forget it. Mm-hmm. He kept his heart right on the center of things.
Yeah.
He wouldn't get lost. I mean, there are times and moments, but not very often. You know, going through this or that struggle. But it was a wonderful relationship. You know, very, the kind of thing you just hunger for, you know, in life.
You know, I have this idea about, you know, Olson brought the outside world to Gloucester, and Vincent sort of was the inside of Gloucester.
Yeah.
And so, like, with it, you know, there's like this yin-yang.
Right, it's a yin-yang.
Yeah.
Cancer the crab. He was very much in his, kind of like in a cave almost.
Yeah.
But it didn't remain a cave. It was not a cave closed off. It was not a hermit cave. Although he was somewhat of a hermit.
Hermit of the clouds.
Yeah. That's right.
So how do we, like, maintain that sort of dynamic tension in this organization?
Through the community gathering. I like Annie's idea, having these dinners every several weeks and having people in. Keeping the place lively, have it be a meeting place, have it be the kind of place that Vincent made it, and reaching out. He loved to go into the schools and work with the kids and stuff. They loved him too. He'd come in, these junior high kids, I remember saying in one of the junior high classes, he said, writing a poem, a good poem, he said, is like having a good shit.
Yeah.
And it kind of shocked them immediately, but not long, you know. That they, it was language they couldn't get away with.
Yeah.
And the teachers probably couldn't get away with, but Vincent could get away with it.
Yeah.
And but he loved interacting.
Mm-hmm.
All ages, very old to the very young.
Yeah.
And just stayed present.
Yeah.
That's a very religious quality, you know, that's the heart of it.
Yeah.
And he was there. He didn't need a church. We don't need churches, but they can be helpful too. I mean, they're not if they're alive and people are coming together and meeting each other and doing things together, fine, what they should be, you know. But we don't have to have them, but we do need communities. And they don't have to be defined as a church or a religious group, they are religious at heart. That is the center of the religious spirit, is to be engaging each other, learn from each other, bringing stuff to each other. It's amazing the impact you have on people over a lifetime. You don't realize it until they start, getting back in touch. I've got these most beautiful letters. I've been sick, you know, from colleagues who I didn't even know were thinking about me, you know. And you know, the people that you've affected in your life. It's why we do our work. You've brought Vincent and Charles to life in those films, the beautiful films of their life. And it's a real gift. It's a real gift to people. Mm-hmm. You just keep doing it. And we're nourished by it. I mean, you don't do it because you're just being altruistic. You're doing it because you get a lot from being able to share yourself, and it's reciprocal. It comes back to you tenfold, you know.
Well, the wonderful thing is that, you know, it's a constant source of learning.
Oh.
So.
Well, I just finished that book now. It took 12 years from conception to getting it in print, and sometimes very lonely work. You got to do. Vincent had very lonely, creative life, and it's nourished by, you know, here and now it's open, now it's closed, more like the clamshell, the opens and shuts. Into the cave and out of the cave, you know, with the care and certain caution, you know, because you'll get attacked. You know, people who are out there get some stuff thrown at them. They got to keep on going. Realize that's part of the life situation. Get to be little pettinesses, and I mean, when Charles took the pen to Vincent and just stabbed him, you know, but it was a gift. Mm-hmm. It was a gift. It was done out of care. Whether Charles thought of it that way or not, when he did it, I think there was a certain jealousy and envy and. Here's some competitor to him, you know. But Vincent was not competitive. He didn't compete with people. He furthered people. Anybody who came to him, he helped them and helped them with their work, encouraged them. Just thought, you know, be who you are. Do what you have to be. And I'm sure he did with your films.
Well, you know, there's only one Vincent Farini. There is only one Louis Armstrong.
That's right. That's right. They're uniques.
Right.
They're uniques, and they're modular. They're modular. They give you a guide.
What do you mean modular?
They become a model to you of a human being in their fullest sense, you know. And not to imitate, but to gather the same creative energy and do what you're able to do with what you, and everybody has some real gifts, and to find them and pursue them and develop them, and they don't stop. There's this beautiful drawing of Goya in his 80s, a self-portrait of an old man with a beard with two canes, and says, "I am always learning." Mm. You know, it's the thing, you know. The really gifted ones, the gift is to keep on being open and keep on knowing there's another. This has led to here, and now this is going to lead to here, and find it, and pursue it, and stay at it, and see it through to the end.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.